Now we've got our beloved Latter-day Liberty expert. We've got Connor Boyack for the Boyack Review. Connor, are you with us?
I am, Jake. How are you?
I'm doing well. So what's on the slate today? What is it that you wanted to talk about?
So, you know, watching the news recently, the big hubbub is over this so-called super committee, right? And you watch all the analysts talking about it. You see what all the pundits are saying. And they've almost universally adopted a narrative about this super committee, which I think is complete, fraud perhaps isn't the right word, but in my opinion, they're missing the picture. For those who aren't aware of what the super committee is, in August, Congress passed the Budget Control Act, and as part of that legislation, it created this so-called super committee, a joint committee with three Republicans from the House and the Senate, and then three Democrats from the House and the Senate, this little confab that was tasked to get together and find $1.5 trillion of cuts as a deficit reduction plan over the next decade. And the goal is to try and solve some of the sovereign debt crisis that we're facing, with the credit rating of America being threatened to be degraded a little bit. So they've been meeting off and on for the past couple of months. They haven't met since the beginning of this month, November. And they just announced yesterday that in a press release, they said, after months of hard work and intense deliberations, we've come to the conclusion today that it will not be possible to make any bipartisan agreement available to the public before the committee's deadline. So in this legislation in August, they were required to find $1.5 trillion before a certain deadline. They came out and acknowledged they're not going to be able to do that.
So basically, they're brand new and they're already failing.
Completely failing. They didn't meet the goals. I mean, first of all, from a constitutional standpoint, this is completely ridiculous for Congress to delegate its own authority to a subset of Congress. What would happen is, had they made some recommendations, the recommendations would be put to a simple majority vote in both chambers of Congress. No amendments would be able to be made, no debate, no discussion whatsoever. This is completely without any constitutional merit, and I think demonstrates a pattern of Congress repeatedly shirking its constitutional duties to basically do what they're sent there to Congress to do. I mean, you look at another example where in the authorization for use of military force, rather than Congress declaring war or issuing letters of mark and reprisal, which the Constitution empowers them to do, they delegated to one man, the president, the ability to declare and wage war whenever he wanted. They like to pass the buck. They like to have lobbyists or think tanks write their legislation. I mean, this shows a consistency of Congress being unwilling to do the hard job that it's been tasked to do. So they created this super committee. They said, you guys find the cuts, and then we'll just vote up or down on them. What's interesting, Jake, is that in this unconstitutional legislative action that they did in August that created the super committee, they put a backup plan in there, a plan B, that says that if they can't find any recommendations, then there will be a $1.2 trillion cut across the board for defense and non-defense discretionary spending. It'll be split evenly. It doesn't go into effect until January 1st of 2013, so they've kicked the can past the election. What's interesting is this will become an election cycle issue that will be, you know, harped on by both sides, no doubt. But what happens is now an automatic cuts go into effect across the board. And what's interesting, I think, is this shows the futility of trying to get a few congressmen to do what people in Congress have been unwilling to do this whole time, is that these cuts, not only is it relatively insignificant, I mean, yes, $1 trillion is a ton of money for you or I, but in the large scheme of things, not only is it only $1 trillion, but it's phased over an entire decade. So, you know, this isn't, you look at someone like Ron Paul who's saying, I want to cut $1 trillion immediately upon taking office. That's a serious, bold action in trying to reduce spending and get our costs under control. But these guys are just, oh, we'll tinker at the edges and we'll do, you know, $100 billion each year over 10 years type of thing. It's
it's like single digit percentage points, whereas we're on a completely unsustainable path. This is just not going to work, and we need something like you mentioned, Ron Paul talking about, you know, $1 trillion, maybe saying to the Federal Reserve, why don't you take a huge write down on the debt that is owed to the Federal Reserve from the Treasury. You know,
right.
All these great ideas. I just don't get it. I mean, people don't seem to have a clue that The thing to me is the general principle of concentration of power. That's what this super committee is about. It's just even, you know, instead of having all the different Congress people, you know, saying what the people want, they've got this concentration of power again, and they can't even get anything done.
They can't get anything done. And even this backup plan that goes into effect, it's completely insignificant. It's phased over 10 years, and, you know, it's supposedly an automatic sure thing. But you've already had, you know, John McCain and Lindsey Graham came out, the Republican who heads up the Armed Forces Division in Congress, the Armed Services Chairman, said that I'm not going to let these military cuts go into effect because we're going to cripple our military. And so they're basically saying even though these automatic cuts begin to go in place on January 1st, 2013, that gives them a full year to try and tinker and create new legislation. You know, it first of all, it's ridiculous to assume that the current Congress can bind the next Congress to do anything. So even though they say that they're doing these things over 10 years, Congress can at any time change that. There's nothing binding that says that it has to forever remain in perpetuity according to how they vote on it right now.
Well, if only they felt that way about the national debt, that it wasn't binding to future generations.
If only, just like Thomas Jefferson said. I like to give this example, though, for this whole super committee issue. I call it super committee. It's just super failure. It's to me, it's like being on the Titanic and the officers trying to negotiate how best to arrange the deck chairs, how many, in what direction, when the Titanic is about to crash in the iceberg and everyone's going to drown. So it's completely insignificant. It's all based on fraud. The people have been hoodwinked, and they think that, you know, oh, had they only been able to come together and reached a bipartisan agreement, even if they did, these cuts are phased over 10 years. The next Congress can totally change them. There's nothing significant. These not only is it not cuts, these are cuts and increases, right? They're assuming that the Congress is going to keep spending more and more as a percentage based on GDP, and they're just saying, oh, we'll reduce that percentage by which we're going to increase our spending. These are not legitimate cuts.
Yeah, it's really, really scary to think that. And you know what's frustrating is we had such high hope. I mean, I frankly can't believe anybody fell for the Tea Party. I mean, these guys go there. Sure, okay, Ron Paul, Rand Paul. That's it, though. Because everybody else has gone in there and is feeding it this this trowel of you know, pork barrel politics. Nothing has changed. It's still the rhetoric, but nothing of substance.
Yeah, I about a year ago came to the conclusion that I've, in many ways, not completely, but in many ways, I've given up on the federal government. There is no sustainable path. There is no way to fix what we currently. I mean, $15 trillion in debt. Come on. Right. I mean, it's just unsustainable. There's going to be a sovereign debt crisis. We're going to have to liquidate. These bailouts that have been propping things up are going to have to stop. The house of cards will come crashing down. That's why I tend to focus more of my political activism and effort at the state level. Let's clean house. Let's cleanse the inner vessel. Let's try and focus on improving our government here such that when the federal government, you know, that when we can't keep sucking at the federal teat to get all of our, you know, freeway dollars and stuff, that we can still, you know, manage our own affairs and be able to look after the needs of our own citizens here in Utah. But this dependency that we have on the federal government and the trajectory it's heading in is completely unsustainable. And I think that we're seeing with the super committee's failure, especially an escalation of the timeline in which the federal government's going to really have a severe debt crisis.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you. I do want to talk about some of the solutions because I know you're involved with the 10th Amendment Center. You know, we're lucky to have Richard Mack coming. He's a big 10th Amendment guy coming tomorrow. We're bouncing against the break right now. Let's come back and talk with Connor Boyack, middle of the Boyack Review, talking about super committees, or in other words, super failures. K-Talk, the voice of Utah. Come on back. Right in the middle of the Boyack Review, we've got Connor Boyack, author of the forthcoming Latter-day Liberty, coming out soon. Connor, that book is pretty much almost ready, right? I mean, when does it ship?
Actually, they just started shipping it a couple days ago. So everyone who pre-ordered on Amazon has been getting them, I think today is mostly what I'm hearing. And so you can just go to Amazon, search for Latter-day Liberty, and it'll come up. They've got it on sale there. You can get it before, you know, Thanksgiving break and start reading it. Makes a great Christmas present. But yeah, we're already shipping and we're out, so it's good.
Okay, good. So people, yeah, like stocking stuffers, and what's probably the best place? Is it Amazon, I'm guessing?
Yeah, Amazon's the best. If you just go to latterdayliberty.com, that's got links to the different places that you can buy it if people don't prefer Amazon for whatever reason. One thing that I've really been pushing that a lot of people have actually taken advantage of is I can get a discount for anyone who orders 20 or more. So a lot of people are ordering them in bulk to give away to, you know, if they're a liberty-minded person who kind of agrees with some of the stuff we talk about on your show, they're ordering a bunch for Christmas presents, and we've sent out a bunch of bulk orders just because people can get it on the cheap and really try and persuade, you know, their parents or siblings or what have you. So that's on the website as well. It's latterdayliberty.com.
Okay, latterdayliberty.com. Now, before the break, we were talking about this this super committee and how you're pretty much past, you're disillusioned, you're past the point of no return with regards to the federal government. So to put your money where your mouth is, you're actually involved quite intimately with the 10th Amendment Center, right?
Yeah, so the 10th Amendment Center is a great organization. It was started a few years ago by a guy in California named Michael Bolden. And we've got chapters, and I think we're in about 30 states, something like that now.
Wow.
We're very active. So I head up the chapter here in Utah. And basically what we do at the 10th Amendment Center is we encourage state legislatures to constitutionally push back against the federal government. We've engendered this mentality in America, whether as a result of, you know, the public school system or what have you, that the courts will save us, or rather that the courts are the proper mechanism through which unconstitutional actions can be corrected. Time has proven that completely fallacious. Yes, you get some victories once in a while, but too often you have these black robe judges who simply uphold whatever the federal government wants to do. So we encourage the state legislatures to push back, whether through nullification, like Tom Woods has a great book. If your listeners haven't read that, they really need to pick it up, just called Nullification, or through something a bit softer called interposition. There's different tools, but basically we encourage the state legislatures to stand up and say, no, you know, we have this contract, you know, we are the compacts to the Constitution as a state. We are arbiters of that Constitution as much as these lawyers are, and we are able to then say, we're going to protect the citizens of Utah, defend them against this, you know, blatantly unconstitutional federal law that you're trying to cram down our throats. And so we've had some great successes all around the country, here in Utah as well. And that's where I think our political capital can best be spent, because you try and send to Washington a politician, even if you agree with them like 80%. You know, I was on Mike Lee's campaign. I helped get him the nomination here to get elected. And I agree with a lot of stuff that Mike does. We disagree on many things as well. But even if you have someone that you agree with, you know, 80% of the time, you're sending them to Mordor, is like what I call it. I mean, you're sending them to the you know, fires of doom and expecting anything to, you know, here's an ice cube to try and put out this massive fire. I think we are so down the road. The Titanic is millimeters away from crashing this iceberg. I would rather see our good statesmen, our principled leaders, work here from Utah and try and push back against the feds and force some change through conflict between the states and the feds, rather than just going to the federal system and trying to work something through the court system and hope that a lawyer happens to agree with you and is ruling. I think that's a bit of misplaced hope, and I think we can have much more success in working at the state line. As Representative Ivory talks about, his big thing is, where's the line? It's that constitutional line that we can push back legitimately against the federal government. We've had some success, and we've got some good bills coming up, and I think we're going to keep doing it and doing it well.
All right, we've got Allie in Salt Lake City who wants to, she's got something to say here. Allie, are you on the line?
Oh, yes. Good afternoon.
Hi, Allie.
Yes, I'm listening to your conversation, and your guest, I guess, he suggests us that if the federal government being limited or bonded with regard to state decision-makings, that could be a solution, and that should happen. Isn't that what he's saying?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to speak for you, Connor, but basically you're saying that the states have rights. I mean, that's the 10th Amendment.
Yeah, I'm saying that of all political entities, the states preceded the federal government. They are the ones that delegated certain powers to the federal government when they created that federal government. So, you know, they are arbiters and enforcers of what the federal government can constitutionally do, yes.
So, in other words, the final word should be to the state rather than to the federal government.
I missed the first part. Sorry, can you repeat it?
In other words, you are saying the final word in any given issue should be to the state, not to the federal government?
To a certain degree. I mean, ultimately, I think the final word is the people themselves, individuals. You know, we talk about states' rights, but that's kind of a mythical thing as well. States are just groups of individuals. You know, this fictional political entity, this group of people, doesn't itself inherently have any rights. So, you know, states more so than the federal government, yes. But ultimately, the people themselves is who has the final decision and say in it.
You're right. So, in other words, you are against the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment should go away or something.
There's lots of amendments that should go away.
Well, I think what he's saying, Ali, is that according to the Constitution and the 10th Amendment, that anything that's not delineated either in the Bill of Rights or the amendments to the Constitution, everything else, the rights are enumerated, and that those rights that are not enumerated go back to the states and the people, which is what the 10th Amendment basically says.
True. It should go to the people of the United States, maybe, not the people of the state. That's why if your guest think the 14th Amendment, for example, should be taken away, he's wrong, because states in their own, they could abuse. They could abuse the grid. There are some states, for example, let's say for the issue of discrimination. To really stop an issue of discrimination, you need the federal rules. You know, you need the federal constitution. In other words, you need the federal courts and the federal government to create the check and balance. Otherwise, the state in its own could become a dictatorship for a specific mindset or faction.
Well, but Ali, I don't think he's arguing that. I think he's arguing that, you know, obviously he's arguing a pro-constitution position, which would say, yes, the amendments, they are the rule of law in the United States. And everything not listed in the Constitution or the amendments, the 10 Bill of Rights or any of the other ones, including the 14th Amendment, everything else should go back to the states. I could be wrong, but.
And I think Ali's comments actually raise an interesting point, and that's a point that was introduced by Senator Santorum in the debates that have been going on. He's raised this in a couple of debates, most recently just this weekend when they had the Family Freedom Forum or whatever that was called. His position is that he quotes Abraham Lincoln, who says that the states don't have the right to do wrong. And by interpreting that, he says that if states are doing something wrong, such as you mentioned racial discrimination or slavery or something that perhaps is morally reprehensible, that the federal government, as a quote-unquote check and balance, has the moral and legitimate authority to intervene and force or require that that state change its behavior, strike down a law, what have you. That is a completely interpretation of the Constitution. The federal government only has the powers that it has been explicitly delegated under the Constitution. To claim that we can, you know, divinely, you know, these legislators that we send to Washington, such as this group on the super committee, can divine what is good and what is evil, and through legislation say to a state, well, we don't have the delegated power to do X, but because, you know, you are doing something that we consider bad at a state level, then we are going to enforce X upon you. They can only do what we as states have allowed them to do. States can and do dumb things, should be allowed to do dumb things, even morally reprehensible things. As long as they haven't delegated to the power to the federal government to allow that federal government to impose upon the states the opposite, then the federal government cannot morally and legitimately do that.
Well, thank you for the answer, and it's a very nice topic you are raising, I think, in your book. Thank you very much, brother.
Hey, thank you, Ali, for the call.
You.
Don't be a stranger. You know, I think this is one of the things that a lot of people get confused on. This is one of the things that I think that was laughable about Herman Cain, for example, when he said that, you know, communities could outlaw mosques.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's clearly just a complete non-understanding of how the Constitution works, that that you can't do that. It's not like this local tyranny. You know, that's why the Anti-Federalists passed insisted on having a Bill of Rights.
Right. Well, and he raised this point and perhaps didn't intend this, but when he asked about the 14th Amendment, that's got some interesting history to it. Whether we're talking about the super committee like we did at the beginning or the 14th Amendment, the federal government so often does things that exceed the moral authority of the Constitution, and then everyone assumes that, well, since the federal government did it, that is the law. The 14th Amendment was passed under duress. You know, Abraham Lincoln and the victors in the Civil War forced the legislators from the South under gunpoint to agree to what they were trying to promote with the 14th Amendment and a whole bunch of the other laws that were being passed at that time. So to say that the 14th Amendment was this thing that we just universally agreed upon and this great amendment that everyone said, yes, let's, you know, pass through majority vote, the southern states and their representatives in government were forced to support it. And so, yes, it's a constitutional amendment now, but when you're talking about the legitimacy by which certain things are done, I think the 14th Amendment, whether the text itself is good or bad, and you can have a debate about that, but the process through which it was introduced and supported, I think is extremely dubious. And, you know, I'm a fan of not only doing things by the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. And I think, you know, whether it's the super committee or, you know, the 14th Amendment, what have you, the federal government is repeatedly arrogating to itself powers it does not have, abusing authorities that it has been given, and we just tolerate it. And so the question is, how do we successfully push back against that? Most people say, well, the Supreme Court. I think that's completely ineffective. It just doesn't work. Sometimes, yes, but rarely. I think the state line is where we do that. You know, going back to that consistent message of the Constitution, again, nullification, Tom Wood's book, he smacks down all the criticisms. He does a masterful job. It's, in my opinion, a must read. Even if you consider nullification a totally reprehensible line of action, the way that he responds to the criticisms, I think, is masterful. He covers this topic. It's been done in many states throughout America's history, whether under the name of nullification or just called, you know, opposition to whatever the federal government is doing. It's been successful. It can be done, and we're going to keep doing it. And I think it's the right way to go about constraining the size and the scope of the federal government.
Yeah, it's kind of a contentious point because, you know, the 14th Amendment also, you know, I tend to see a lot of people who tend to be Democrats maybe favoring the 14th Amendment for what they perceive it to be. But, you know, these same people don't realize that it was the 14th Amendment that has been largely interpreted to give corporations personhood. There's all kinds of nonsense that came from the 14th Amendment. The 16th Amendment brought us the progressive income tax, which has been largely to fund war and kill babies and innocent people in foreign countries. The 17th Amendment, I mean, and even the Constitution itself. I mean, you know, blacks were only one-eighth of a person or
three-fifths.
Three-fifths, thank you, yes. And women couldn't vote. It doesn't mean that you throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're looking at the spirit of this. And we're looking at, thank goodness for the anti-federalists who put through this idea of a Bill of Rights and whatnot. But, you know, I think it's important that we understand, and I can't remember the decision off the top of my head, but I know it's a recent one, that the Supreme Court actually came behind that not only does the 10th Amendment favor states' rights, but even individual rights.
Mm-hmm.
That even if the federal government came down on you for something, you could use as an individual. You don't even have to be a state to argue against it. And so things like, you know, the war on drugs or any kind of federal law that you think is rather ridiculous, you actually have a shot based on Supreme
Court
precedent.
Standing in the courts, right, yeah.
Yeah, these are contentious things. It doesn't mean they're cut and dry. And you know, I'm glad Ali seems to have at least an interest in the Constitution and looking into it. But the other thing is, you know, and Murray Rothbard makes his point eloquently that the Constitution's a piece of paper. And as such, it's interpreted by people. And so, you know, there are people out there like Tom Woods who are interpreting it for liberty. Guys like Randy Barnett who are actually, instead of looking at original intent or looking at it as a living document, wants to suggest the presumption of liberty when reading the Constitution, which I think is a brilliant idea. So,
right.
I mean, I think this is a good thing that the dialogue is now moving to another level of sophistication about the Constitution. You know?
Well, I completely agree. I mean, you talk about the super committee being a super failure. I think we need to stop relying and being dependent upon our, you know, masters in the federal government, whether we call them representatives or bureaucrats or president, to save the day, to fix the situation. We need to have a real significant introspection to see if we really understand liberty, if we're prepared to defend it, if we know how to stand up for our own rights. I mean, it's like a property line. If your neighbor continues to encroach upon your property, unless you know explicitly where your property line is, you don't know where to push back. We need to know where to push back. That's the Constitution.
Yeah, I love it, man. Hey, thanks for the report today, Connor. We will be back tomorrow with Richard Mack speaking of the 10th Amendment right here in studio on Mental Self Defense Radio on KTalk, the voice of Utah. Come back tomorrow. Take care.
If you are drowning underwater, have been denied for loan modification, have fallen behind on your payment,